from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Human lifespans expanded over the last century thanks to medical advances like vaccines and antibiotics. This century will bring even greater scientific breakthroughs, says our guest tonight, technologist and immortality advocate Ray Kurzweil. And if baby boomers take the proper precaution, says Kurzweil, they too will be in a position to take advantage of the 200-year-long lifespan that is just decades away. Tonight on Point, the case for nearly endless human life and the science that could make it happen. But first, we go to New York, where earlier today, the investment bank Morgan Stanley settled a landmark sex bias suit for $54 million. Hours before the case was set to go to trial, Washington Post staff writer Brooke Masters has been covering the story. She joins me now. Hi, Brooke. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what was decided here today, and why did Morgan Stanley decide to settle at the last minute?
Well, under this settlement deal, Morgan Stanley pays $54 million. And most of the money, $40 million of it, goes into a pot that a group of women who work there or used to work there can then sort of draw down. They can make claims trying to show that they were discriminated against. And if a special master, which is kind of like an appointed judge, decides they were discriminated against, they can use the money. They can, you know, make a claim on some of the money and get it. Morgan Stanley also paid $12 million to Ali Shiflin, who is a trader who brought the original complaint to the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, which are their federal government regulators, and they kind of enforce the employment laws.
What was the backstory here? What was going on that brought Ali Shiflin forward with her complaint?
Ali Shiflin had been working in what's known as the Institutional Equities Department, and this is the division of Morgan Stanley that does trading for their really big clients, the mutual funds and the hedge funds. And she alleged in 1998 that she had been passed over for promotion because she was a woman. And in her complaint, she alleged things like the guys she worked with, you know, would go out with her and her clients, who were largely male, and they would, you know, go out to a nice dinner, and then they'd put her in a cab, send her home, and they'd take the clients off to strip clubs. And this sort of deprived her of opportunities. And then also she alleged that Morgan Stanley didn't promote her because she's female. After she filed her complaint in 2000, she was fired by Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley says that's because she was rude to her boss, who happened to be female as well. She says it's because she filed the complaint.
Brooke, you cover white-collar crime and securities regulation. You know New York well. Is this going to send off a ripple through some kind of boys' club on Wall Street?
Well, Wall Street is well-known, or allegedly well-known, as a place that's not very pleasant for women. This is the third major investment bank to pay big money in some kind of sex or gender discrimination lawsuit. Smith Barney, which is now part of Citigroup, and Merrill Lynch have both paid upwards of $100 million between them to settle complaints.
And why do you think Smith Barney came out and settled at the last minute like this?
Morgan Stanley, excuse me.
Were they afraid that all this dirty linen was going to be pulled out, or it was going to cost them more? What does it look like?
They won't say, but my sense from talking to people who wouldn't want to be quoted on the record is that they both thought, you know, it would be 3 or 4 weeks of absolutely lousy publicity. You know, there were upwards of 20 women ready to come forward and tell their stories, which largely included things like they just didn't get raises and promotions, but also included nasty stuff like, you know, breast-shaped birthday cakes and allegations of strippers at work and nasty comments. There also was a sense, I think, Morgan Stanley's workforce is 48% female, and that in addition to there just being lousy publicity in general, that it was going to really be hard for the firm itself to endure a trial.
Brooke, $54 million is a lot of money, but if you're Morgan Stanley, it's not so much money. Is there something in this settlement today that is likely to be able to really challenge the kind of testosterone-driven culture of that culture, setting?
What's interesting is this was an EEOC lawsuit rather than just a class action lawsuit, which meant that the settlement had to include more than just cash. Unlike most of these previous settlements, Morgan Stanley has committed to 3 years of monitoring by an outside lawyer to make sure that they're actually making progress, and also to invest in actual diversity programs, and have a point person who is an internal employee who will also sort of make sure that they're doing decent diversity work. So for 3 years at least, they're going to have to try and do a good job of making the place more hospitable to women. And the thought is that, you know, the EEOC has sort of laid down its gauntlet, saying, though, we will go after Morgan Stanley, and we will go after you, i.e. the rest of Wall Street, mm-hmm. if you guys don't shape up.
And what's the sense you're getting from the street in New York today? Is this a reformable culture based on this kind of challenge, or a tougher nut to crack than that?
Well, you know, it's a heavily male-dominated industry, particularly at the upper levels. The Securities Industry Association's last survey said that, you know, 19% of managing directors, which is the level we're talking about in this case, they're sort of up, you know, mid to upper level women in their 30s and 40s. So 19% of people in that position are female. That's a really small percentage. And I think to a certain extent, the atmosphere is not conducive to change. On the other hand, you know, nobody wants to be shelling out $54 million.
And they're going to have oversight breathing down their neck, at least for one company now. Brooke Masters, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Brooke Masters is a Washington Post staff writer who covers white-collar crime and securities regulation. She spoke with me from Mamaroneck, New York. Ray Kurzweil is a legendary dynamo of human innovation. He's founded 9 businesses in everything from speech recognition to artificial intelligence. He's been awarded 12 honorary doctorates, been awarded the National Medal of Technology, and named to the National Inventors Hall of Fame. Now, Ray Kurzweil's restless mind is focused on human life. Lots of it. The supercharged convergence of biology, computing, and nanotechnology, he says, is about to radically extend human life to 150 years, to 200 years, and maybe to immortality. And all of this within your lifetime, if you can just hang on. Tonight on Point, the case for nearly endless human life and the science that could make it happen. Can you imagine bioengineering and nanobots endlessly rebuilding your body and mind, perhaps for centuries? Is this the old fountain of youth mirage, or is science about to deliver something new? And if the sky becomes the limit, how long would you want to live? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Ray Kurzweil, innovator, technologist, and author of the best-selling book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, When Computers Exceed Human Intelligence. He is co-author of the forthcoming book, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. Good evening and welcome, Ray Kurzweil.
Good to see you again, Tom.
It's good to see you. Thanks for being with us. Okay, it doesn't get much more provocative than this. Since Alexander the Great and Ponce de Leon, people have been talking about a fountain of youth. Don't tell us you're holding out just another mirage here, that it's just around the corner. Trust me, you're going to live forever. Why should people stand up and believe this any more heartily than they've believed, you know, the sort of failed promises of thousands of years about immortality?
We have to look at the state of technology and the fact that it is accelerating, growing exponentially, and we're really at the cusp where technologies like biotechnology and nanotechnology are rapidly picking up speed. So even baby boomers, like ourselves, can slow down aging and disease processes using today's knowledge, which we call Bridge One, to such a degree that you can remain in good health until the more radical life-extending and life-enhancing technologies, which are now being developed, many of which are being tested, become available. So we talk about Bridge One extensively, how you can slow down these aging processes much more than people realize, and we've been very successful in doing that. And then we talk about these bridges to come. Biotech is in the early stages now. It'll reach its sort of golden era about a decade from now. We'll actually be able to change our genes, not just designer babies, but designer baby boomers. Mm-hmm. We have a technology called RNA interference that can actually turn off genes. And most diseases, viral diseases, cancer, use gene expression. So that's a very powerful tool. We'll ultimately be able to actually insert new genes, gene therapy. We'll be able to regrow our tissues and organs from our own cells, turn our skin cells into heart cells, and rejuvenate our hearts and every other organ. And that's a bridge to the nanotechnology revolution that's really in a very early stage now, but 20 years from now will be the golden era of nanotechnology, where we can actually go beyond biology and beyond its limits. Because biology, although we hear how remarkable it is, and it is very clever and has very intricate designs, it's also very limited. And as we find out the principles of operation of our bodies, we're finding that we can actually redesign our blood cells, our white blood cells, our interneuronal connections in our brain to be hundreds or thousands of times more capable. So we ultimately will go beyond biology and really stop and reverse aging processes and be able to really extend human life indefinitely.
Beyond biology, that, of course, means beyond nature. And you're saying that without blanching.
Right. I mean, nature is limited. We were evolved in an era which was very different than today, in which it was really in the interest of the species to not live very long because, you know, once you're past child-rearing age, you're using up the precious resources of the clan. There is some research recently suggesting that it was good to have a few old people around to kind of provide their wisdom. But mostly, lifespans were very short. That was natural. It was life expectancy was 37 200 years ago.
We still live on a resource-short planet, do we not? Isn't that dynamic still there in some extent?
We're going to have the means through nanotechnology and as well as biotechnology to vastly expand our material resources. We've already done that with our technology. You know, we didn't have social safety nets 200 years ago. It took 6 hours to prepare the evening meal. We're already immeasurably better off due to our technology, and that's going to accelerate. We have outmoded programs in our genes. One says, hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season might not work out so well. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good program. We'd like to change that program. We've actually figured out how to do that. Some research at the Joslin Diabetes Center has shown that blocking a single gene, the fat insulin receptor gene, can enable these animals and ultimately humans to eat as much as they wanted and remain slim and get the health benefits of caloric restriction. They actually lived longer.
We're going to come back and look at all of this. You're talking about 150 years, 200 years, even immortality. But let me ask you, a couple of years ago in the Scientific American, three authors put out a story called No Truth to the Fountain of Youth. And they said, hawking the anti-aging therapies has taken a particularly troubling turn of late. Disturbingly large numbers of entrepreneurs are luring gullible and frequently desperate customers of all ages to longevity clinics. And it's time to stand up and say, these things don't work. Are you saying they were wrong, or they were right then but wrong now, or they're going to be wrong in 20 years?
Well, I think that's a very conservative view. I mean, I think we've demonstrated ourselves. I can give you my own story, which maybe we'll get to, on the ability to really radically slow down aging processes using today's knowledge. My co-author, Terry Grossman, runs a very successful longevity clinic and has, it's one of those clinics which has VIPs coming from around the world. I was one of them and is very successful at really slowing down aging processes. And the whole message really is that baby boomers can slow down these aging and disease processes, which are exponential and gradual, to such an extent that when these more radical technologies are fully developed, and these are really well along and a lot closer than people realize, we can still be in good shape.
So you're saying, hang on, it's just 10 or 20 years away that the next bridge to very long life, as you describe it, is
coming. I mean, you hear very often, you know, do certain things, exercise, stop smoking, till they add 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. That's looking backwards. Statistically, at the past, it's not taking into consideration the dramatic new technologies we have. I mean, there are therapies in the pipeline right now which will stop and reverse atherosclerosis, which kills, you know, a very substantial fraction of people.
Heart disease, in effect.
Yeah, there's dramatic new technologies for stopping cancer, diabetes, stroke. We're actually learning the precise mechanisms behind these diseases and developing drugs which attack them very precisely.
Ray Kurzweil has a kind of cookbook. We're going to come back and look at it. We're talking tonight about radically expanding the human lifespan to 150 years or more, and maybe in time for you, maybe soon. You can join our conversation tonight. Can you imagine we might be on the verge of super long life, of eternal life here on Earth in your lifetime? Are you ready for this? Does Ray Kurzweil's case sound credible to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I've been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about radically expanding the human lifespan to 150 years or more, maybe forever, and maybe in time for you, maybe soon. My guest is Ray Kurzweil, innovator, technologist, and futurist, author of, co-author of the forthcoming book, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. You can join our conversation tonight. Can you see bioengineering and nanotechnology endlessly rebuilding your body and mind, perhaps for hundreds of years? If technology makes it possible, how long do you want to live? To 150, to 200 more? Are you prepared to make significant lifestyle changes now for a chance at being around when the life extension tech really kicks in? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Ray Kurzweil, I know you've got a kind of formula for getting from here to what you describe as these future bridges, but take us to those bridges first, because when a lot of people think about living for a long, long time, they think of living, with all the travails of aging, infirmity, and it's just not as fun. You're not just talking about, as I read you here, about getting old in the traditional fashion. You're talking about technologies that would actually rebuild the body and mind eventually from within to keep it something like perpetually young.
That's right. I mean, I think it's important to understand a basic message here, that our paradigm shift rate, the rate of technical progress, is accelerating. It's getting faster and faster, and people don't take that into consideration. They assume that the current rate of change will continue. Biotechnology is speeding up. We're really learning the software programs embedded in our genes and learning how to reprogram those. And we're learning how to specifically turn off the mechanisms underlying disease. We're learning the five or six steps involved in atherosclerosis, the various processes that cancer cells go through, and finding many different ways to short-circuit those diseases. We really will make huge strides in those diseases, as well as aging processes over the next decade.
But even with that, you're talking about living forever. It's right there in the subtitle. Isn't that a hyperbole? I mean, do you really mean us to be thinking about immortality here?
Well, I mean, consider the metaphor of maintaining a house. How long does a house last? It really depends on how well you take care of it. If you don't do anything, the house will collapse. If you aggressively take care of it, proactively take care of the structure, repair all damage, confront all dangers, renovate parts of it from time to time with new materials, new technologies, it can go on forever. Now, where that metaphor breaks down is that we understand all the mechanisms behind a house. We don't yet have all of the knowledge of the principles of operation of our biology. But that knowledge is growing exponentially, and we really will have reverse-engineered biology within a decade to a decade and a half.
So give us some more examples of how science might permit interventions to do the equivalent of home maintenance on a body. Which parts of the body? You say body and mind. How the mind? How the body?
Well, I've mentioned a few things with biotech, but let's jump to the next bridge, the one that really will bring radical life extension, which is nanotechnology. And the key message is going to be...
And nanotechnology being the infinitely small, the very molecularly small...
Being able to actually engineer things at the molecular level, mm-hmm. building them molecule by molecule. It's in an early stage, but within a couple decades, we really will have the means of creating blood cell-sized robots. We call them nanobots. And we'll have millions or billions of them in our bloodstream, and they'll do a lot of different things. I mean, if one thing, they will basically keep our cells well-repaired. They'll get rid of debris, they'll kill cancer cells and pathogens. We'll be able to replace our red blood cells and white blood cells with them to be far more capable. We'll be able to add new interneuronal connections. We do most of our thinking in the interneuronal connections in our brain, which only process at electrochemical speeds, which are very slow. They're actually a million times slower than electronic circuits. We ultimately will be able to speed up our thinking. I give one example in the book of replacing our red blood cells with what are called respiracytes, robotic red blood cells, which a nanotechnology theorist, Rob Freitas, has designed. And these are actually fairly simple. They store oxygen.
The cells that carry oxygen around the body.
They do the same thing as the red blood cells, but it actually brings up the limitations of our biology. These robotic versions are hundreds or thousands of times more capable. And a conservative analysis was done of these respiracytes, and if you replaced 10% of your red blood cells with these respiracytes, you could do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath, or you could sit at the bottom of your pool for 4 hours. Because it's far more capable.
Because these new artificially created cells would be able to hold the oxygen for that long and use it at a different
rate. That's right. They'd be designed optimally. There's a design for robotic white blood cells, similarly, that are hundreds of times more capable. I actually watched in a microscope my own white blood cell destroy a bacteria, and it took an hour and a half. I mean, our white blood cells are remarkable on the one hand, but they're very slow and sluggish. The robotic versions would do that in a few seconds. They could download software from the Internet to destroy any specific pathogen, cancer cell, viruses, and so on.
So I'm going to go home, plug in to my Internet connection, have myself reprogrammed. At this point, you're not just talking about longer life. You're talking about a different kind of life. I mean, that can think so much faster, that can sit at the bottom of the pool for 4 hours and upload new software. Is that still human life, or is it something else?
Well, just to make a point, if it sounds very futuristic, I'd point out that we already have nanobots, robotic devices the size of blood cells, working in animals. There's one design that actually cures type 1 diabetes. It works in animals, and human trials will start soon. There's four major conferences already on these devices. We already have neural implants, which are computers placed in people's brains. This is an FDA-approved implant for Parkinson's disease that downloads new software upgrades from outside the patient. So these are not as futuristic as they sound. And I would define human life as we are the species that naturally seeks to extend our horizons. We didn't stay on the ground. We didn't stay on the planet. We haven't stayed with the limitations of our biology. Human life expectancy was 37 in 1800. So we always seek to extend our horizons. And we're going to make ourselves physically more capable and, most importantly, mentally more capable by developing these very intimate connections with our own technology. Our technology really is part of the human civilization.
This raises so many issues. My brain's going to explode. I may need your software upgrade very quickly here, Ray. We have a lot of callers who want to join us as well. I want to turn to them. Michael is calling from Manhattan. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Certainly what you've brought up has a lot of allure, and also, you know, it brings a lot of things to mind. But I'm just sort of curious because I think I'm curious about how rosy a picture you're painting. I mean, I have a little bit of a personal experience right now because one of my relatives was just diagnosed with breast cancer. You're saying that basically this stuff is all going to happen in the next 15 years, but that would indicate that virtually everything else is going to come along too in terms of finding cures for cancer. Is this stuff that's already there but normal folk don't have access to it? It's only VIPs and the people who have incredible material resources that have access to it, or How do you respond to that?
We've got it. So if the science is so great, why isn't it helping Michael's relative with breast cancer right now? And does somebody have access to this? Not Michael, not us.
Well, I mean, we do have a regulatory process and that's a whole controversial issue, but it does tend to slow things down. We do have some exciting new technologies for cancer and heart disease, and they have to go through the FDA process. We are actually speeding that up. There are technologies like simulation that ultimately will replace animal tests and even phase one trials, so we can concentrate on the human trials and things like that. And the FDA itself has been accelerating things. They're very exciting ideas, but they're going to have to be approved. And there's a different story on each issue. I'm particularly encouraged with heart disease. There are therapies that, for example, boost HDL, that, for example, APOAI Milano, it's a new drug that's been tested that actually showed significant regression of atherosclerosis, the cause of heart disease, in a small period of time. And we talk about each of these diseases, each of these aging processes. Aging is not one thing. There's 8 or 10 different processes, and there's different strategies for each one. Strategies that you can deploy now, the Bridge One, to slow down these aging processes, and then strategies for developing new technologies in biotech and nanotech that ultimately will enable us to overcome these completely.
But let's talk about cancer right now, because out there tonight, there are plenty of people with cancer who need a cure today, and of course, many of them are not getting it. You sort of blithely earlier said, well, we'll cure cancer, but if we haven't done that in all these years, what makes you so confident that will happen in the coming years, even the sort of near-horizon years?
Well, I'll give you one idea that's useful and that someone actually could pursue. Chemotherapy drugs actually do work, but we don't know which ones work. There's only a 25% chance that any chemotherapy drug will work for you. And one drug is actually not enough because cancer evolves. It uses evolution And so if you hit it with one attack, it'll evolve around it. You need a cocktail. It's the same message we learned with AIDS, that you have to attack the HIV virus with two or three different
coming up
attacks.
From a lot of angles, yeah.
Well, how do you find three chemotherapy drugs that work if there's only a 1 in 4 chance that each one will work? Well, one answer is to use an assay, which is actually test the chemotherapy drug on the individual patient's cancer.
The sort of personally tailored medicine we're hearing more
right,
about.
Right, and to actually test it in a laboratory dish, try 15 different drugs, find two or three that work, develop a cocktail that's specialized for that patient. That's something we could actually do now, and there are a number of companies, one of which I'm involved in, that actually is pursuing that idea. So that's one idea of many that has a lot of promise.
And what about Michael's further point, the sort of suspicion or question of whether this will be available to everyone or this is going to be sort of intrinsically available only to an exclusive circle, to the rich, let's say? Is it going to be a tiny minority of wealthy humans who live for hundreds of years and everybody else somewhere back in the pack?
I mean, inherently, all these technologies basically are information. And it's the nature of information technologies that they double their price performance every year. That means you can get the same information a year later for half the price. So if you look at any technology, whether it's a health technology or computers, it starts out expensive and not working very well, and a few years later, it's actually working quite well and it's very inexpensive. I mean, look at AIDS drugs. It used to cost $30,000 or $40,000 per patient per year. It's now down to hundreds of dollars. And so it's beginning to be able to help the third world. It's still too expensive. There's a lot more we should be doing to help those people. But
you're saying essentially, yes, at the beginning, it's only going to be for an exclusive group, but it will spread in time as the technology becomes
particularly as it actually begins to work better. I mean, there are early adopters where the things are expensive and don't work that well. Ultimately, these are information technologies, and they eventually are very inexpensive.
Michael in New York, thanks for your call. Pam is calling from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Hi, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
Before I make my point, I just want to say that, you know, I'm lying here on the sofa with shivers running down my spine. I first learned of these ideas reading Bill McKibben's excellent book, Enough, last year.
Mm-hmm.
Which I would highly recommend to anybody in your listening audience. I think it's one of the most important books written in the past 5 years.
And kind of the counter view from the get-go in Bill's book.
Yes, exactly. The point I'd like to make is about human overpopulation. Right now, suburban sprawl in the United States consumes more than 500,000 acres of forest and farmland every year.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is a problem worldwide. There are a number of problems with this idea, this concept of prolonging human life. But, you know, where will all these people live?
So if everybody's sticking around for centuries, are we just going to be stacked up to the moon? And will that be any fun?
Exactly. And, you know, what's going to happen to other species? Although I know that Kurzweil will say, well, you know, we can just reinvent them. We can recreate them through nanotechnology. I think this playing God is really, really dangerous. I mean, if people prolong their lives through good health and nutrition and exercise, that's one thing. But I just think these ideas are very, very dangerous.
Pam, let us pick it up. Rick Kurzweil, how about it? For overpopulation, the environment, is this a doomsday scenario here?
Well, I've debated Bill McKibben, and he basically makes the point that technology has been a good thing, but enough is enough, and let's stop technology. I think that's not a morally defensible position. We still have enormous amount of suffering in our society. I mean, we mentioned a lot of that, people with cancer and other diseases, and we're close at hand to having technologies that will save many lives, and that's something that we really need to proceed with. A common mistake that people make when they consider the future is to envision a major change, like we're talking about today, radical life extension, as if nothing else was going to change in the world. And if that were true, if we just had people living indefinitely and nothing else was going to change, that would create problems. But you have to look at the future world in terms of many different dimensions. Biotechnology is going to, nanotechnology is going to provide means of cleaning up the environment. It's going to provide the means of creating virtually any physical product from information and very inexpensive raw materials, leading really to radical wealth creation. We'll have the means to meet the material needs of really any conceivable size population of biological humans. We've seen that gains in prosperity have resulted in declines in population growth. Now, a dramatic drop in the death rate may reverse that, but we're going to see dramatic gains in productivity. We're already seeing that.
But still, people don't want to live in cocoons. They need room to walk around, to live. I mean, there is a finite amount of space on this planet.
There's more space than... Take a train trip around, you know, any part of the world. You'll see there's enormous amount of space. We really don't have the means of providing for the material needs of people, but that is changing. We do have exponential growing economies because of the productivity growth. That's going to actually accelerate even more with these dramatic new technologies. We'll be able to really create anything physical and meet all of our material needs.
And dramatic wealth creation, you say. So paint us a picture of the culture you might imagine in which this longevity is playing out. Are you talking about, I mean, do you really imagine a planet full of super wealthy humans with all the material needs taken care of by kind of an Aladdin in a lamp of nanotechnology? Is that realistic? Is that feasible?
We'll be struggling with different things. I mean, we will be able to meet, you know, the material struggles we have today. I mean, if you were described today to people 200 years ago, they would find it mind-boggling, and they might question, gee, do we really want to go there, and is it really worth it? But if you really compare today's life to the extremely hard labor, no social safety nets, if any misfortune happened to a family, they were thrown into desperation, and there was lots of opportunity for that because there were no antibiotics and no sanitation. So we've come a long way, and we're going to continue that improvement. We will come to a point where we'll be worrying less about the things we worry about today, but we'll still be seeking to expand human knowledge, which I think is really the primary destiny of our civilization. And knowledge, I include, you know, culture, language, music, art, science. I mean, that's what we're going to be struggling with. We're going to struggle to get along with each other. I mean, this is not going to create a utopia.
And when you say we, do you mean humans alive today or do you mean humans generations hence?
The whole point of our book is that we have the means of slowing down aging to such a degree with today's knowledge that you and I, for example, baby boomers, can be in good shape and, you know, when these more radical technologies come around. I mean, I've written for many years about the technologies that are coming in the future. It's something I want to see, and I believe that's feasible. You know, when I was...
Ray, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break. We'll get the story when we come back. We're talking tonight with Ray Kurzweil. He's co-author of the forthcoming book, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. You can join our conversation tonight. Do we need immortal humans? Is that good for the planet? Is that good for the humans? And if life lasts forever, what are you going to do with it? How much of it do you want? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're even older, and now you're even older. You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're older still.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about radically expanding the human lifespan to 150 years or more, maybe forever. And maybe in time for you, maybe soon. My guest is Ray Kurzweil. He's an innovator, technologist, and futurist, co-author of the forthcoming book, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for this? Does this sound like science fiction, like an impossibly ambitious self-help book? And if technology makes it possible, how long do you want to live? 150, 200, more? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Stephanie's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi there, Tom, and hi to Ray Kurzweil. First of all, I want to say that I am a real big fan of Ray Kurzweil's.
He's got an amazing record all over the map, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And I have a visual impairment, which has really gotten worse over the years, and I may need his reading machine. He invented a reading machine for people that can't see.
Right.
And I think he's wonderful. And the whole thing is that, you know, I think you can't really, to me, technology is neutral. You know, you really have to, you think of the pros and cons and the ethics of it, but, I mean, I have to admit my initial response was, you know, why? But I guess here's my question, really. Why would we want to live forever or live longer? That's my whole question, especially given this culture in America, where age is really feared, you know.
Stephanie, we'll ask that, but let me ask you first, what if you weren't aged? What if you were living a long, long time, but you had essentially the attributes of youth, nanobots inside sort of replenishing, rejuvenating everything? Would that make a difference or not in your question?
I was thinking about that, and I'll tell you, I mean, I love life, and I've had my ups and downs. I'm 54 years old, and the whole idea of what is old is really, it just, the boundaries are really being pushed.
Yeah.
I think it would depend on what facilities I had to accomplish the things I wanted to accomplish. But I think, to me, you really want to be part of a meaningful social relationships, social networks, and you'd want to be able to contribute to the world. And
it could be scary if you couldn't count on that, maybe couldn't count on other things as well. Let's get Ray Kurzweil's response.
Well, I think it's a legitimate question to ask, you know, won't it get boring to live hundreds of years, even if we were in good shape, even if we stayed 35 or 40. I think if humans lived many hundreds of years with no other change in the nature of human life, I think it would lead to a deep ennui. But we're also going to be expanding our capabilities, not just physically, but more importantly, mentally. We're going to really be able to expand our experiences through things like full immersion virtual reality. We're going to be able to expand our intelligence through this intimate connection with non-biological intelligence. And so these are some of the things I've written about. And, you know, you can make a strong argument that that's already happened. I mean, look at the, you know, tremendous ability we have to experience and to create intellectual products through our technology today, and this is just the beginning. So
you think then life will just become so much more splendid because we'll be so much more intelligent and able to swim laps for days on end? And
well, I think the caller actually makes a good point that technology is neutral. And whereas on the one hand, we will be able to clean up problems that Bill McKibben and others worry about. I mean, he was the first one to write about global warming, and we have, you know, grave environmental problems caused by actually pretty old technology, industrialization, and things like nanotechnology and nanobots in the environment will enable us to make great progress with cleaning up some of the old problems. They're going to introduce new problems. We struggle with software viruses today, and we'll have the means of, you know, new biological viruses that people can create, or nanotechnology viruses and things like that.
Bottom line, you're seeing a vigor and an intellectual potential in this greatly expanded life that will make it fascinating, Stephanie.
Overall, I think life is much better today than it was 200 years ago. Because of the intellectual stimulation, we're going to expand the potential of human capability and experience far greater with these new technologies.
Let's get one more call. Jonah's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Jonah. You're on the air.
God bless you, and thank you for your show.
Sure. Thank you.
I find it fascinating what Dr. Kurzweil is pursuing. I just needed to point out the aspect of spirit and God in our life. I have been very technologically inclined, interested in nanotechnology and some of these very same things that he speaks of, but there's a point where I just had a schism with society, or rather my place within it, and which meditation and prayer brought about a realization of some of God's law.
Jonah, do I hear you saying that you fear that some kind of immortality may be in conflict with a spiritual life?
No. Exactly. In a way, it's exactly opposite, because we were granted immortal life anyway as long as we live within the realm of our own soul.
Rick Kurzweil, I hear you wanting to jump in.
Well, I mean, this is a multifaceted issue you bring up, but let me make one point about that I think these types of technologies are moving in a spiritually positive direction. I mean, if we think, you know, how is God described in the Bible? I mean, it's an abstract concept of being infinite in creativity, intelligence, beauty, love, all-knowing, and so on, something that we as humans, finite humans, are unable to achieve. But these technologies are going to allow us to expand exponentially our memory, our intelligence, our creativity, and therefore move in the direction of being more expressive and more creative. And I think, you know, these are spiritually valuable qualities. that ultimately we'll be able to move forward in.
So you're seeing it as supplementing or buttressing or even building the capacity for the spiritual life. We've just got a couple minutes left, and we've barely touched on what you call the first phase, and that is living long enough to get to the period where this science unfolds. You've been making an experiment of yourself for the last 15, 20 years. What's the cookbook recipe in a nutshell here, Ray? We've just got a minute and a half.
Well, the book is not a one-trick pony. We don't, you know, tell you eat grapefruit or just lower your carbs. Mm-hmm. Or we really provide you a comprehensive guide to understanding how your body works. And there's, you know, a dozen different important processes, and we describe them and describe how you can really slow down the aging or disease processes. I'll mention, you know, one surprising idea which people aren't aware of. Our cell membranes are comprised largely when we're young of something called phosphatidylcholine. It's a wonderful substance that lets nutrients in, lets toxins out. By the time you get to be elderly, that's down to maybe 10%, so the cell membrane gets replaced with hard fats and cholesterol. Mm-hmm. That's one of the dozen important aging processes. Well, you can actually stop and reverse that process by supplementing with this substance, phosphatidylcholine.
You've got a whole list of supplements here that you're saying,
right.
That's
a unique aspect of our program. Aside from nutrition and other things, our bodies evolved in a different era, and we need to really reprogram our biochemistry. I feel I'm reprogramming my biochemistry the way I reprogram my computers. And I've really been very successful. I mean, according to aging tests, I have not aged significantly in the last 16 years. I feel that way. And so through this kind of very active interventions, you can achieve that.
Well, you're looking pretty fit. Maybe you're on that bridge one to bridge two and three and infinity and beyond. It's mind-boggling, but you open up our eyes to a big horizon. Ray Kurzweil, great talking with you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Ray Kurzweil, co-author of the forthcoming book out this fall, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. In a moment, a literary look at the unending pursuit of youth. This is On Point. Science looks to the practical challenges of increasing human lifespans. Literature examines its costs and consequences. Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray stayed young while his painted portrait grew old and ugly. Christopher Marlowe had his Dr. Faustus trade his soul for immortality. Now, acclaimed young novelist Andrew Sean Greer writes the story of Max Tivoli, a man born into an elderly body who gets physically younger as he gets older. The Confessions of Max Tivoli is a sad, enchanting story of the essential solitude of life, regardless of age, experience, or vigor. In this radio diary, Andrew Sean Greer reads from his new book and explains the inspiration behind his story of inescapable youth.
Partially, it's, of course, the novelist's job to throw a wrench into anyone's fantasy. But it's also the idea that getting older would be more than just your body. It would be the accumulation of the years, and that you can't belong to a different generation than the one you're part of. And that's sort of what he's stuck in. He can't actually enjoy being a boy when he becomes one because he wants to be an old man because he's in love with an old woman. So that there's something sort of off about the experience in the body, and when that happens, you can be left sort of undone. Of course, the other end of that is people I know who are 60 and look in the mirror and they don't see anyone they recognize. They're like, I'm 36. Who is this person in the mirror? Which is Max goes through in the reverse way. I think there's an important part of sort of accepting a different part of your life and not sort of trying to stop at a certain place. A lot of it is the act of imagination, of the thought of what someone would become if they had a great gift of possibilities and they sort of squandered them. And, you know, the writing act is an incredibly lonely one. You're sitting there all alone. And often, that's the first thing that comes to mind, is the solitude. Well, it sounds like the least likely inspiration, but it was a Bob Dylan song that I was sort of singing to myself as I was distracting myself from writing, called My Back Pages, and it goes, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. It's the same sentiment of being sort of changing and growing more aware of yourself or feeling younger at a different point in your life.
We'll meet on edges soon, said I, proud neath heated brow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
We all hate what we become. I'm not the only one. I've seen women staring at themselves in restaurant mirrors while their husbands are away. Women under their own spell as they see someone they do not recognize. I have seen men back from war squinting at themselves in shop windows as they feel their skull beneath their skin. They thought they would shed the worst of youth and gain the best of age, but time drifted over them, sand burying their old hopes. Mine is a very different story, but it all turns out the same. Inside this wretched body, I grow old, but outside, in every part of me but my mind and soul, I grow young. There is no name for what I am. Doctors do not understand me. My very cells wriggle the wrong way in the slides, divide and echo back their ignorance. But I think of myself as having an ancient curse, the one that Hamlet put upon Polonius before he punctured the old man like a balloon, that, like a crab, I go backwards. For even now as I write, I look to be a boy of 12. At nearly 60, there is sand in my knickers and mud across the brim of my cap. I have a smile like the core of an apple. Yet once I seemed a handsome man of 22 with a gun and a gas mask. And before that, a man in his 30s, trying to find his lover in an earthquake, and a hardworking 40, and a terrified 50, and older as we approach my birth. Anyone can grow old, my father always said, through the bouquet of his cigar smoke, but I burst into the world as if from the other end of life, and the days since then have been ones of physical reversion, of erasing the wrinkles around my eyes, darkening the white and the gray in my hair, bringing younger muscle to my arms and dew to my skin, growing tall, and then shrinking into the hairless, harmless boy who scrawls this pale confession. A moon calf, a changeling, a thing so out of joint with the human race that I have stood in the street and hated every man in love, every widow in her long weeds, every child dragged along by a loving dog. Drunk on gin, I have sworn and spat at passing strangers who took me for the opposite of what I was inside, an adult when I was a child, a boy now that I'm an old man. I have learned compassion since then, and pity passers-by a little, as I, more than anyone, know what they have yet to live through.
Andrew Sean Greer, reading from his new novel, The Confessions of Max Tivoli. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.